This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Confringe reading series. Alrighty, folks, it's time to get going again, and our second reader should be well known to everybody as the man who asks questions, but today we're actually going to hear some more of his fiction. So would you please give a warm welcome to Mr. Justin Newland.
Thank you very much. I've got two stories for you this evening. One a short story and the other the first chapter of the novel. So I'll start with a short story. This is a ghost story which is going to be part of Ian and Pete's anthology, which the North Bristol Writers Group are working on. This offering is called Vallum Hadriani, and it begins. Tullus wanted to scratch his back, but he couldn't reach beneath his heavy tunic, and his arm movements were restricted by the breastplate and armour. By Jupiter, his back still itched. All the same, the scratches reminded him of Morgant's and better times. His sword made a grating sound as he rammed it into its sheath. Grabbing his shield, he climbed the ladder, gloved hands against icy rungs. He emerged onto the watchtower. The low rolling hills were covered in a pool of white by another snowfall. Dawn was oozing out of the horizon. With the new recruit from Gaul was Marius, his nemesis. "So the Praetorian is awake," Marius snarled. Since his disgrace, these jibes had been his daily fare for a year. They were like an open wound, and sometimes he wearied of trying to stem their flow. Mostly he took his barbs during the day and one by one removed them at night from his mind. Only scars remained. "I'm confused," the Gaul said. The man still wore a down of fluff on his chin. The Roman army took them young these days. "What about?" Tullus asked. "If you're Praetorian, why are you here guarding the Vallum?" the Gaul asked. The tinge of awe in his voice betrayed a respect for the fierce protectors of the emperor. Before Tullus could reply, Marius swooped. "Don't let him fool you, Alum." Oh, so that was the Gaul's name. "Tullus doesn't guard anything. Instead, he's like some ghostly numina. He floats around the snows of Caledonia, and he's the worst kind of ghost. He's a deserter." Marius prodded the air with a lean finger. "No, I'm not," Tullus insisted for the thousandth time. "Yes, he'd left his post, but it was for a good reason." The trouble was no one believed him, least of all the emperor whose life he'd accidentally endangered. Now these frigid hills and dales were the bars of his prison. "Praetorius Tullus wasn't falsely conscripted like you and me," Marius continued, as if he wasn't there. "No, he was once a member of Hadrian's vaunted guard." "Yes, I was, and no matter how much you goad me, you'll never take that away from me. Once our mighty Tullus protected consuls, slept with their wives and beat their servants. Today it's his duty to keep a watchful eye on an unfinished wall and a ditch full of dirt. While he's not sleeping with his whore." Marius made a rude fist. "She's no whore," Tullus yelled. The barbs were digging deep. Marius jutted his chin at him with utter disdain. "I'm a Brigantes, and even I wouldn't poke Morgant's." "You're mad," Tullus said, vapours of anger rising before his eyes. "I'm mad," Tullus snapped back. "Then how come no one's ever seen her?" Tullus pulled at his dagger and lurched at Marius. In a flash, Alum stood between them, one arm pressed against Tullus' chest, the other against Marius. "Stop this," Alum snarled. "By the gods," Tullus said, panting and sheathing his dagger. "One day I'll vindicate myself. I'll show you I was right all along." "Of course you will. Now start your watch, coward." Marius spat the word out as he descended the ladder. Alum threw Tullus a look of confused disdain and followed the Brigantes. Typical Marius, like a bat out of the twilight and then vanish. Tullus was alone. He escaped to the place where he always went for solace, to Morgant's. In his mind, he conjured her sleek body and imagined her pressed close to him, close to him, close to him. His reverie was interrupted, though, by sounds, distant sounds of men marching, hundreds of boots crunching the ice-bound road. Along the wall by the nearest mile station, the men from the 2nd Legion were already heading towards him to start the day's construction work. Until they arrived, he, Talus Maximus Gordanus, was the vanguard, the sole guardian of the temporary end of the long wall, long curtain of wall and ditch that snaked out from one coast and reached towards the other. This was the nearest he got to the days when he basked in the warm brilliance of the task of guarding the most important man on the world. To keep from freezing on the spot, he trudged the turret perimeter. His breath was steamy and his hands already numb from the cold. Dawn was casting splashes of crimson across the frozen landscape. Even he, a Sardinian far from home, bore a begrudging appreciation for its stark, homogeneous beauty. He peered down to the ground at the base of the turret and noticed track marks in the snow. They came from the north, the Picts' land, and stopped in front of the turret. They weren't Alums. He'd have come from the east by way of the Mile Station. Why hadn't Marius spotted them during his watch? They didn't look like footprints or paws. He scaled the outer ladder to take a closer look. He was right. The tracks were freshly made and neither human nor animal. Three undulating lines, one above the other, like waves in the sea. Wait, by the Vestal Virgins, they were the same marks as last year. Not again. Memories of his disgrace flooded back to him when the Emperor Hadrian had visited these parts to commission the wall. That morning, Talus had followed the same wavy lines into the woods. Convinced they were a warning of impending danger, he tracked them as far as a rock near a frozen pool where he'd encountered Morgantz, an alluring undine with flame-red hair. Entranced by her beauty, he strayed from both his path and his duty. Out of that slither of opportunity came a horde of Picts. In a wave of blue death, they wreaked havoc on the Mile Station, disemboweling men and raping women. After a bloody battle, the Picts were repulsed, and every one of them eviscerated. A pyramid of skulls was gruesome testament to the Romans' retribution, which made Hadrian's clemency to Talus all the more surprising. Mitigated by Talus' exemplary service, the Emperor had condemned him to spend the rest of his days chained to the scene of his fall from grace, the wall. Since then, Morgantz had not deserted him and stayed by his side during the day, always out of sight of prying eyes, all the while sending him erotic dreams at night that soothed his anguish. She made him feel like a man, and he'd grown to trust her again. They were her tracks. She said she'd come help restore his pride and position. She was sending him a sign. This was it. The Picts were coming again. They'd wait until dawn and swarm through the rising evening mists. If he discovered the enemy's dispositions, he'd redeem himself. He strode off to the north towards the forest, his hands and feet like frozen lumps of stone. So much white. The silence pristine, the forest thick, the path winding and narrow. Bare trees. In a clearing far off, he glimpsed a horde of Picts, prickly as thistles, plotting, goading each other on. Years passed. Let's avenge our brave dead, one was brandishing a club. Now they're building this wall. With their pathetic eagles, they despise our gods. They're besmirching our sacred land. Let's take it back from the invaders. He had to return before the Picts attacked. He crept away, silent as a snowdrop, and stumbled into the forest, beating heart. A frozen pool, a rock, a woman, beguiling, beckoning. It was Morgantz. There she was. She would rescue him. He never felt so much joy, so much relief. He lay down and felt her wings embrace him, and lay back in ecstasy. Scene break. Talus awoke to loud voices. Can you still see his tracks? It was Marius. At last! I'm over here, Talus shouted. This forest is alive with spirits, Alan was saying. Come on, tonight's the last night of Saturnalia. Let's get back to camp. I only want to be served by the centurion. Ha, forget it. You'll be the dish being served if we don't find the deserter, Marius replied. No, that wasn't right. He hadn't deserted, not again. Over there, the Picts are mounting an attack, Talus yelled. Can't you hear them? Can't you hear me? Marius' torch was sending flickering lights around the trunks and branches. Macabre shadows danced on the frozen pool. As dust settled, the owl of Minerva spread its wings. Alum, I found him, he's here, Marius called out. Help me, I can't move my legs or arms, Talus murmured. This was odd, they definitely couldn't hear him. Alam said, "How did he end up slumped against this tree?" Marius kicked him hard in the thigh. His body crumpled and fell limp on the ground. Strange, he felt no pain. "Stop that," Alan protested. "Don't the Brigantes show respect for the dead?" "We do," Marius scoffed, "when they deserve it. Listen, as part of his punishment, Hadrian had his whipped to the, had him whipped to the edge of death. Talus convinced himself the wounds on his back came from wild lovemaking with Morgantz. He was obsessed. She was a spirit and only existed in his dreams. She was Numina." "Well, now they're Numina together," Alam said. End. Thank you very much. This is the opening chapter to my novel, The Genes of Isis. And it begins with a saying of the ancients, which is, "Egypt knows you, but do you know the Egypt in you?" Chapter 1, The Wheel of Change. Akasha awoke to the sound of the winds howling outside her temple cell and the clamour from the night bell. Clouds of crimson dust scraped against the window like a scaled serpent, jarring her nerves. The winds moaned through the temple's cloisters, muffling shouts and cries of alarm. A door banged and slammed shut, irritated by the malevolent winds. For a moment the visibility cleared, and she could see the silhouette of the old oak of Samelios in the centre of the cloisters. The winds had stripped its early spring leaves, but at least it was intact. The pale green dress hanging on the door reminded her that today was the day she was supposed to have visited the Emerald Cavern. Oh, that awful place. Who wanted to sit in a chamber and make themselves infertile? Not her. Yet everyone in Samnis was obsessed with the place. In these winds, she wasn't going anywhere near inside that cavern. The feeling of release was quickly replaced by an inrushing sense of foreboding. Squinting through the billowing dust, she swallowed hard on a dry mouth. The winds gathered into a swirling vortex of power around the old oak. A loud and ominous cracking sound plunged the city into a horrendous silence. In disbelief, she peered into the cloisters. The winds had severed one of the oak's lower large branches, which lay forlorn on the earth. They toyed with the rump, rolling it over and over. Then they tore into the main tree with such ferocity that even the trunk strained its mighty sinews. Like the furies, they scraped at the tree until, with a noise like a thunderclap, the huge trunk cracked. The great oak creaked, tilted and plummeted to the ground like some ancient titan felled in battle. Its upper branches smashed through the window opening of her cell, depositing an unwelcome sprinkling of twigs on the floor. Covering her head with her hands, she ducked behind the window ledge. The oak of Samnius was broken, snapped in two by the earth's vitriol. It was reputed to have been planted by old Enoch himself. Had they offended him? Why are these winds? Were they a pestilence or a cleansing? Personally, she benefited from them, but evidently not her city. She had to tell her mentor. Shamira would know the answers to these questions. With all her strength, she pushed against the door, but the buffeting wind prevented her from opening it even a crack. Trapped, she yelled for help. Her cries echoed back to her. So did her hopes of rescue. As the winds abated, the door fell ajar. Then they picked up again, snaking through the gap, upending curtains and drapes. Leaning headlong into it, she squeezed through the tiny opening. The door slammed shut behind her. Her nightcap squirted down the corridor and vanished into the frenzied dawn. She joined the throng of people fleeing the temple and emerged into a heaving maelstrom of salt and sand. The particles hit her with such speed that she felt like her skin felt like it was pierced by a thousand minuscule daggers. Clouds of dust splintered into her eyes. The wind slanted into her as she struggled into the bared teeth of the gale. Outside the temple entrance, the winds had unceremoniously toppled the statues of the divinities from their plinths, which lay on the ground in undignified fragments, their long reigns brought to a sudden and premature end. The path to the stepwell was strewn with branches and debris, all coated with the crimson dust. Off the lee of the isle were two waterspouts, reaching from the angry seas all the way up to the heaving sky waters. Swarms of gulls and seabirds swooped and dived in the airstream, blown hither and thither like stray twigs. Staggering down to the stepwell was an achievement in itself. She paused for breath and scanned the carnage. The portico had collapsed. The night bell swayed black and forth, issuing a terrible din. The winds blew leaves and dirt and sand and spray into her face. She ducked to avoid a branch that flew at her, as if thrown by some invisible hand. Tross, the gatekeeper, was staring down into the stepwell. "The Oak of Samelius, it's gone," she yelled. Tross shook his head and lowered the scarf over his mouth. "There's nothing we can do," he shouted back. He was right. "What are you doing down here?" "The men are trying to pinion some material over the pool," he said, pointing down to the pool at the base of the stepwell. He was ever the practical one. To survive the onslaught, they need to protect the city's main source of fresh water. "Let me help." "No, get to the cathedral with everyone else," he said. After what seemed like a lifetime of evading the sylph-like monster, she glimpsed the murky outline of the cathedral at the top of Spirit Hill. The crystals on its outer surface were smeared with that crimson dust, as was the roof of the Emerald Cavern next to it. At least she'd been spared from her visit there today. What was the point of this devastation? Was it to do with the hybrids? Everything else in their lives was, so she guessed the wild winds were too. Again, Shamira would know. Hundreds of people were squeezed into the rotunda, all statuesque, as if the tempest had sucked out their spirits and turned them to stone. None even spoke to her, their eerie silence in stark contrast to the raging storm outside. Glum-faced, the men stood around the perimeter, backs against the wall. The women sat huddled together in small groups in the centre of the rotunda, comforting each other, nursing the injured. Akasha caught a glimpse of her face reflected in one of the crystals. Through a film of grime, the whites of her chestnut eyes shone through. She reached down to lift up the hem of her skirt and realised she was still wearing a nightdress, now a ghastly shade of red. Shamira was tending to an elderly lady, Irit. "There," she was saying, "you've had a shock. Drink some water. You'll be fine." "Thank you," Irit replied, her voice barely audible. Shamira turned and greeted Akasha warmly. "I'm glad you're here. I was worried about you. Are you all right?" "Yes, I think so," she said. Except what? "I've some bad news. The winds demolished the Oak of Samias, sapping it right in two. All those years as a symbol of strength, broken in a moment." Shamira seemed unconcerned and said, "Well, it's a sad day for Samelius, but our lives are more important." Panion headed towards them in long, loping strides. He greeted everyone and spoke to Shamira. "All the citizens are safe, and that's good, but I'm worried, and so are the people. We've never been confined like this before, not by the winds, not by anything. These are portent, these are winds of change. You're the augur, Shamira. Tell us, what is your reading of the runes?" Even for a high priest, that was a fascinating question. As Shamira's apprentice, her mentor was always telling her about these mysterious runes. Invisible to the naked eye, they ran through the astral light in the same way currents and tides move through the sky waters and the earth's oceans. Shamira's face wore that pinched look she had when prophesying, and her lisp was always accentuated as she said, "Our friends in Cathay, in the east, and the land of the clouds in the west, as well as the Solari in Egypt, we all feel the sting of the great winds in our faces. In the physical realms, the tempests will remove the old and infirm and break the rotten bough, allowing birth and renewal. Everything begins and ends in the astral light, in the unseen causative realms, where the wheel of change takes another turn on its axis. What we witness are its grand and spectacular effects. The future is unfolding, and only that which belongs to it will survive." Her mind was a whirlwind of questions. She wanted to belong to this future. But how could she achieve it? Shamira could see it, couldn't she? She must know. Panion asked again, "Was there anything in the runes about the surge?" Shamira pursed her lips. "These winds herald the last days of this epoch," she said. "The source is desperate to unveil the next one. Already he's issued the surge, which lies dormant inside every one of us. Its release restrained by the scourge of the hybrid seed. First that stain must be removed, then and only then will we be able to drink from the refreshing waters of the next epoch." The winds were ushering in something new, and that was the surge, and that was profoundly significant. Akasha loved hearing about it. If only the surge would flower in her lifetime, she'd enjoy wondrous new faculties that had never existed before, and arts and skills no one had ever conceived of. She'd join a race of geniuses. That was the promise. The winds were propelling the wheel of change, all right. They were driving out the past and bringing in the future, fast. The end of an epoch. These were more than interesting times. Thank you very much.
We don't have any ghosts today, but we do have possibly a poltergeist or something causing the lights in the pub to go down every so often. Oh dear, our barman there who is clearly up with all the lingo says he's using the force on us. He may well, of course, as Joe says, be using the dark side. We don't know. Anyway, Stephanie, I know you've got to go and catch a train shortly. Have you got any questions for Justin?
Well, I was just going to say I love the atmosphere in the short story that you read, and I wondered what particularly inspired that.
Fear of Celtic witches, obviously.
I suppose a combination of things. Just got curious about Hadrian's Wall. And was looking for a setting for a ghost story, really. And I got a picture of an unfinished wall and just worked from that, really. And like probably like you, did a virtual visit, you know, looked at the tourist pictures and, you know, these little bits of wall and read a bit of the Roman history about Praetorian guards and, you know, just the pieces come together, and that's the, you know, part of the joy of authorship, isn't it?
The thing that struck me about that Roman story was the character was called Talus, who's a character from Greek mythology, isn't he a mechanical man made by Hephaestus? oh well, yeah. There we go. It's all my classical training there getting in the way of understanding the story. But no, it's good to see that you're teaching people to be afraid of Celtic witches, because we are very, very dangerous. And you should not put any trust in us. We've heard quite a bit of this Genes of Isis novel, as you've read it in open mics and whatever. Is there any chance that we're actually going to see it published any time, do you think?
Oh, yeah. There's some definite steps in that direction, yeah. So I basically not looked for a submission until this year, so just started to look. You know, working on submission packages and all the rest of it. So definitely, yeah.
And from the other excerpts we've seen, it appears to be set in Atlantis. Is that a reasonable...
It did have references. I decided to take them out because it didn't really add anything to the story and possibly detracted from it, just using that as a kind of mythical setting. I felt the story had enough, you know, momentum in it without the need of a reference to Atlantis. So I changed it just to call the place Samlios, which curiously, you know, I did some research into, you know, prehistory, if you like, and came across a guy named Edgar Cayce, who apparently lived, you know, and I think in the 60s, and had kind of dream visions of what things used to be like a long, 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 long time ago. And he kind of spoke about these kind of places like Atlantis and different kinds of races of people that existed at the time. And I got the name from there, really, Samlios. So a lot of the work I do, I kind of piece together bits of history and put in the fiction and put in the supernatural. And often, you know, like to work that way. So that's kind of what I've tried to do in here, although it didn't come out so much in this chapter, but it does later on. There's some alternate history elements.
I should note, by the way, that Hadrian was a famously gay Roman emperor. So we've clearly got an LGBT theme going today. Right. So, anybody else got any questions for Justin? Yeah, I thought you would.
So, Genes of Isis. Obviously, there's a a resonance with Genesis. And I know who Isis is, but why genes? Because genes are a very modern concept.
Don't know how he spells it yet.
Well, you know, you do a Google on it, and it does come up as a possible definition. Although you'd think that at the time the first book of the Bible was written and translated into English, obviously genes probably did not exist as a word. But it's a curious link between the two. I mean, I think I would characterize it in this way, that the story of the myth of Isis is about the gathering together of different parts of a fragmented human race and bringing it into one, and that's the kind of metaphor for it, if you like. Of bringing together almost like a salvage job of what can be saved from a disintegrating human race. And that's kind of the theme of The Genes of Isis, the novel that I've written. The genes, yeah, it's a modern term. So I've replaced it by the word seed, because I felt in the novel it didn't fit the time I was trying to create. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Ian?
Question possibly for both of you. So you're writing in historical settings. How do you strike a balance between writing sort of characters with a sensibility which is going to make sense to a modern reader, and going back to trying to tap into the mindset of the time in which you're writing, which might be impenetrable to modern reader? I'm presuming you're sort of finding a point somewhere in between, but where do you kind of, you know, do you, is it midpoint, or, you know, where do you go with that?
I'd say that I try to stick pretty closely to a real plausible historical viewpoint. I mean, the nice thing is there's a wide range of opinions and attitudes at all the historical periods, just like there is now. But the other thing is trying to show where the social pressures are coming in to influence people in ways to have attitudes that we don't recognize or that we don't resonate with ourselves, and showing why they're feeling that way makes a big difference. I would also say, this isn't something that, you know, particularly comes up with either of ours, but just in terms of that question, I think something that happens when you're writing a historical and you have to decide, do I let my character have this opinion that we now really strongly disagree with? You know, there are ways to do that in which you show that the character has this opinion because of these various things, but you make it clear in the book that that is not the author's, not the authorial message, and it's not how you're not in any way trying to give that an attitude.
I suppose in short, if I was to give a one-word answer, I'd say it's impossible to write a book today, a historical fiction book, where the whole of the mindset of the people of the historical time is portrayed in the book. One, it's impossible because no one would be interested to read it. And two, I don't think it's possible for an author to think in the same way consistently, 100%, of all his characters. You know, genuinely, what it was like to live. Because that's what you have to do. If you want to think, you know, understand Egypt, you've got to think like an Egyptian, for example. So if you want to understand Habsburg, you've got to think like one. And you know, live, literally live. I suppose actors are the nearest that might get to it. And that's where I suppose, you know, art and life merge, you know. So,
I just, I have ideas. I just wanted to say that something that's really, really helpful for me when I'm getting ready to set something in a historical era is to read the diaries and the letters of people of the time period, because that's, you know, for instance, my children's books are set in Jane Austen's England, and it's one thing to read the novels set then, but if you read Jane Austen's letters, she has a very different tone of voice in those, and, you know, reading a much more direct, much more natural kind of expression from there is really helpful in trying to get into that kind of mindset.
That's a good way. I can see that, because it's finding that source material that can be really difficult, and then kind of tapping into it, you know, even to the point of, well, I suppose, you know, like with the acting, the clothes they wear, even the way they walk, the balances, the diseases they were prone to, why were they prone to those diseases? I mean, it's a whole culture, isn't it, that you try and soak yourself in. And I suppose, you know, it's down the line of method acting. That's what they try and do, isn't it?
That's a really good question, Ian, and I'm reminded of the recent interview that I put up on Salon Futura with Guy Gavriel Kaye. I was talking to him for the Ujima radio show about writing Children of Earth and Sky. Now, Guy takes about 2 years to write a book. He does that much research in order to get it right. He's absolutely obsessed with the history. And with this particular book, he spent a long time talking to medieval historians, people who were experts on the Balkans in the period that he was interested in. But he still wanted to tell a story. And one of the things that he does try to do in his books is to find roles for women in the society. So he spent a lot of time talking to them, what could women do that I could have them as characters in the novel and still have a certain amount of agency. So there are three women altogether who have a certain amount of agency. One of them is a brilliant archer, so she actually gets involved in the fighting because she's so good that the men have to admit that they need her along. The other two both rise to power through religious orders. So there's an order of nuns, and they become involved in it and become abbesses or prioresses or whatever in that. So from that point of view, he's tried really hard to find a way to make the book accessible to the modern reader, but still have believable historical agency. And then I listened to a podcast done by three Australian men, who I won't name and shame. And they started off saying, well, of course, this book is like completely modern. It's totally ahistorical, because in the real medieval period, none of these women would ever be able to have that sort of lives. So you, no matter what you do, somebody is going to think it's wrong.
Yes, I just wanted to confirm that the most maddening thing that's inevitable and you just have to accept, it's not when someone criticizes your book for something that you think, fine, you know, your opinion, it's fine. But when they say, that would never have happened, and you think, it happened 10 times, you know, in that year alone. You know, it happened again and again, but you can't get online and fight about it, you know.
Joe, you had a question.
Yeah, it was a horrible question about process for Justin, because he always asks me about my process. As Jane's of Isis obviously has gone through multiple incarnations, because we've all heard bits of it. So I'd just like to know, you know, what problems you had with it and how you overcame them.
Well, the initial problems was that I wasn't a very good writer. I needed a lot of practice to get better. Having written hundreds of, you know, nearly 200,000 words, and, you know, getting a lot of help from folks like yourself, John Gerald, you know, writers groups, Pete and Ian and so on, and, you know, just getting lost in the book, coming back. I suppose it's about a fourth incarnation, you know, seriously different version that it's come to now, you know, just hard work as well, and just belief that, you know, this was the story I really wanted to tell. I left it for about 2 or 3 years and wrote two more novels just to try and, you know, get more of the backstory, because they were prequels, but also to get into the way of writing novels, you know, to understand what the process was, or understand better. And, you know, I guess like most novelists, you know, you're always learning, because now I decided, well, I'm going to start writing in a new world, so I'm starting something new. It's all the more difficult, as you have to research everything all the time to start and, you know, reconfigure that new world. But that's what writing's about, isn't it? Particularly historical based writing. Yeah.
Okay, we need to have a short break now because I'm afraid Stephanie needs to go and catch her train. So let's let her get herself organised. Alrighty, anybody got any more questions for Justin? Or did we manage to do that break at entirely the right time? I've derailed your train of thought, haven't I? Okay, has anybody got any announcements? Joe, can you remember when the next Fringe is?
July.
Yes, the next Fringe will be in July. July the 18th.
And we will be having a horror special.
It'll be a horror special. So who will the readers be?
Tom Parker and Tim Leben.
Ooh, Tim Leben there. Yes, well, that should certainly be very interesting.
Also, look. I
had no idea that Tim lived in Abergavenny. Oh, it's clearly a righteous mecca. Perhaps I should move there or something. It's quite convenient for the Brecon Beacons and for hay. And yeah. Right, okay. Anybody else got any other announcements? Pete, you've got a book launch coming up, Ian? Yeah, right. So.
Yeah, myself and Ian. I'm launching A Tiding of Magpies, which is my short story collection. And Ian's launching Silence Rides Alone, which is his Western, and that's on the 30th of this month, so the very last day of this month, in St. John in the Wall, which is a fantastic venue, and we're in the crypt. Don't know if you want to say anything, Ian, about your book or anything?
My book's out already, so you can buy it and then can buy another one. That'd be really good. Please do come along. That'd be great to see as many people as possible.
Okay, so that's two great books then by Pete Sutton and Ian Milstead. Definitely looking forward to that. Ah, yes. Right. So, yes, Ian, explain, please.
Good point. Mine is as Charles Milstead, which Charles is one of my middle names, so I picked that partly to differentiate from the huge amounts of science fiction which I've written and odd bits of comics journalism, and partly because it just sounded a bit more westerny, really. It's not so different that people can't identify me, which I'm sort of quite happy for people to do so.
Suggestions off microphone there that he should call himself Chuck Milstead, which would be a very Western name. So, yeah, possibly. Anybody got any other non-punny announcements to make? Or indeed, any punny announcements to make, if you can manage it.
I don't have any punny announcements, but it is pub night in here next week.
Okay, and there's nothing much from me because I'm rushing off to FinCon for a couple of weeks and whatever, so I shan't be around, but I will be back in time for the next Fringe. Anybody else? Nope. In which case, we are done for the night.
Thank you.
Thank you. BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.